made here, and also
Catherine Handy.
And now that I'm here, I realize that you are surrounded by a wonderful cadre of colleagues. I think that the folks that have been chairing the panels have not just been sort of empty chairs, but have been quite active in terms of stimulating discussion. That's really welcome. I also want to thank you for mentioning the conference that we're organizing at Princeton.
Can you hear there? Okay.
Yeah. So the conference that we're having at Princeton in the spring, I want to encourage anyone who's interested to let me know. I have plenty of copies of our call for proposals, and we would certainly welcome any and all ideas. So the topic that I'm talking about today stems from the research that I did last year, and really the research that I've been doing for many years in Russia. And it seems to me that when one thinks about courts, and especially civil justice in Russia, there are really two narratives that come to mind. One is the narrative out of the popular press, which talks endlessly about the horrors of civil justice in Russia, about how slow it is, how expensive, how corrupt, how incompetent, on and on and on. And I think this is a very powerful narrative, both in Russia and in the West. And the other narrative is a narrative of the judges themselves and of the judicial institution. And it is a narrative more of them as victims, how overworked they are, how many cases they have. And of course, there's something deeply contradictory about these two narratives. It's odd to have a situation where the popular press is talking about how horrible the courts are, but yet the courts are overcrowded. So this is an odd situation to have. And the question of how this works is not really my topic today. Instead, I've addressed that in another paper, and I'd be happy to come back to that in the Q&A. But today what I want to do is unpack that narrative of overworked judges, overcrowded courts, and answer this question of whether perhaps there is too much access to justice, and that's the idea of too much of a good thing. And so the research puzzle, in a way, comes out of my own experiences spending time in the Justice of the Peace Courts, the Mirovye Sudy, in Russia. I looked at the data before I arrived there, and it's really impressive, the number of cases that they deal with. And so I assumed that my problem would be having too many cases to observe. And you would go to the courts, and they would be packed to the gills with people waiting and all kinds of exciting things happening, at least exciting to me. And when I arrived at these courts, often they were empty. Often there was no one there. Even though sometimes there was an active, looked like to be an active calendar of cases. Sometimes when you went on the websites, and as most of you probably know, you can now access the calendar of cases online. And so this led me to start thinking about, well, what's really going on here? Why is it that on the one hand, they complain all the time about being crowded, and this is something that comes out not just in the data, and I'll show you a bit of the data, but also in the what I would think of as kind of the popular law review literature. There are journals now devoted to the Justice of the Peace Courts, and they have many, many interviews with Justices of the Peace, and they talk about the difficulty of their work and this idea that being sumishishaya or insane is something that literally comes from their mouths. And of course, this wonderful survey that was done by the Institute for Applied Law at European University also documents their very firm belief that they are terribly, terribly overworked. And one of the problems with having so many cases on your docket is that it creates a kind of conveyor belt mindset, and judges often use this very term to talk about the way they think about their job, and that is not the way we usually think about justice, that we want justice to be careful and considered, and in fact there's a certain irony in this, because the Justice of the Peace Courts were created as a way, one of the reasons was as a way to alleviate pressure on the district or on the schools, because they were too busy. And so we just basically transferred the problem to a lower level of courts, although I don't think it has, I think relief for the district courts was temporary, and they are now continue to be very, very busy. I should say at the outset that this phenomenon that I observed in the Justice of the Peace courts was less true in the arbitrage courts. And I also spent time in the arbitrage courts last year, and of course, during the 90s, I spent a huge amount of time in these courts. So let's look a little bit at the data. Let's start with the arbitrage courts. And here we just see a snapshot. We look at 2002 and 2011, and then I have a statistic that gives you the increase in the total number of cases in between the 2 years. And so what we observe here is an increase in the number of cases without a proportional increase in the number of judges. So the number of judges stays more or less static, and the number of cases increases, and that leads to a very high caseload in certain parts of Russia. And I always think it's interesting to break down and go past just the Russian Federation and to look at the regions. Although, to be honest, doing this is not that easy because the regional data, of course, are not public. And so then it requires some effort to get these data. The Moscow City Arbitrage Court is traditionally the busiest court, and so not surprisingly, it is the busiest when you look at it in terms of the monthly caseload. Although, when you look at the 2002 numbers, you see that I think they're the very high number of judges, because they also have the most judges of any court, any arbitrage court in Russia. So the story there is that the data would seem to support this narrative of overworked, terribly victimized judges. And so if we look at the Justice of the Peace courts, and also here, these data are not published other than the Russian Federation data. So here are just broken down by Okrug, and not the slide just would permit me to do all of them. And so we see here, first of all, the a very high level of cases that if you're having to do well over 100 cases a month, just civil cases, and then your administrative cases. And I did include criminal cases because that's not part of my discussion today, but there really is a very small number of criminal cases heard by the Justice and Peace Courts simply because of the jurisdictional boundaries of it. And here I think it's worth noting, talking a little bit about some of the regional variation here, that the Central Okrug, which includes Moscow, is disproportionately low in terms of the caseload. And the reason here, I think, is quite interesting, that a few years ago, they decreased the maximum amount of property disputes. So it went from 100,000 rubles down to 50,000 rubles. And this has had an unusual effect in Moscow, where the cost of living is higher, and 50,000 rubles doesn't go as far. And so you don't get as many cases like this. And I think that's why that number is unusually low. Now, I think it's a whole separate question of what's going on in the Far East, and I have no answers to that. I think mostly with tables like this, you're just creating future research projects for yourself because you see these very interesting numbers and then you want to explain them, and that will require field work in these different regions. So, again, when we just look at the basic data, it would seem like, well, of course, this story that they're telling is true. But let's think a little bit more about this and think about what might be the problem with this official version, this narrative that the judges tell. One problem is that it assumes that all cases are the same, right? It treats every case as being identical to the other. And this is an approach that is, I don't know that it's unique to Russia, but it certainly is not the approach that is adopted in judicial statistics elsewhere in the world. Certainly in the United States and in most of Western Europe, they take a weighted case approach so that you look at what the time is that you think a case would take to settle or to resolve, and then you factor that into what it means in terms of the time needed for judges. I personally have always been very frustrated with the way in which statistics are collected, both in the arbitrage courts and the courts of general jurisdiction. And it's a difficult problem to deal with because, as a rule, I found that the people that are in these judicial statistics departments are fantastic, that they're very well-meaning, they're trying to do their best, but for a long to a large extent, they're collecting garbage, and there's only so much you can do with garbage. And because they're just obsessed with all of these different types of cases. So you have this very, very kind of detailed story of every provision, basically, of the criminal code and lots of parts of the civil code and all different kinds of contract disputes in the arbitrage courts, and who wins and who loses, just as a gross number. But as a person schooled in kind of socio-legal methods, it's very frustrating not to be able to get some purchase on who are the litigants in these cases. Other than in the courts of general jurisdiction, they will give you whether it's an individual or a legal entity or a individual or a legal entity, and that's somewhat helpful. But there's a great deal of theoretical literature that goes to the question of whether someone is a large enterprise, what we think of as a repeat player, and we can't know from the statistics whether someone has gone to court multiple times. Anyway, so I could go on forever about my dissatisfaction with the statistics, but we do with it what we can, and I think we're grateful to have the data that we have. So one problem is this assumption of fungibility of the cases. The other problem is that it really, and this is a corollary to the problem of fungibility, is the idea that many of the cases that are brought to courts in Russia are what we would think of as empty cases, and judges sometimes refer to them literally as empty pustoy, or cases without a real question involved. And in the arbitrage court, one of the types of cases that comes to mind are insurance cases, that there are lots and lots of these cases, and they have increased in number over time as insurance companies have become more and more litigious. And one of the things that was striking to me as I sat in the arbitrage courts and watched what was going on is that there would be a day where there would maybe be 10 or 15 of these cases on the docket, and maybe none of them would show up. And so I got to talking to the judges about this, and they said, oh, these aren't, they, again, described them as basically empty cases, and said that they're brought simply to get the court orders. And I said, well, why did they do it? And they said, oh, we don't really know. Why did they bother doing it? And their best explanation was that it was a way to delay the obligation to pay. And, of course, there's some rationality to that. But it sort of disappears when you realize that if this is insurance company versus insurance company, then at one point you, insurance company A, are going to be the plaintiff, and at other times you, insurance company B, are going to be the defendant. So if we all were just good actors and paid on time, then wouldn't it just make more sense? But anyway, I sadly do not run the world and cannot control the behavior of insurance companies. So the point is, this may be a settling out process, and certainly in terms of the literature on the legal history literature in the U.S., there's this wonderful article by Bob Kagan where he talks about the ruthization of debt collection. He talks about how for many years in the United States and in other West European countries, they used the courts actively to collect debts, and gradually they realized that this was a very, very expensive way to collect debt, and just the reputational effects clicked in. And they began paying when the debt was suggested rather than waiting for that. But the bottom line here is that we see that if we just look at the Moscow City arbitrage courts, that this category, as a percentage of all contractual cases, moved from less than 1% to 38%. And if you look at the paper is available on SSRN if you're interested. I look at this in other regions as well, and you see that this is a significant category of cases. And then in terms of the courts of general jurisdiction, there are these cases that are decided by what would loosely be translated as judicial order, or sudebny prikaz. And there, to be honest, this was a procedural tool that I had been unaware of until I spent time in the Justice of the Peace courts, and basically it allows in certain categories of cases, it allows the plaintiff to be able to get a judgment without having a hearing. So it's a one-sided process. And if we look here at the use of these we see that even if we look at all of the general jurisdiction courts, it's over half of the cases, over half of the civil cases. And if we look at all the Justice of the Peace courts, it jumps up to over two-thirds of all the cases. And then if we look at individual courts, And the one that really pops out here is the Leningrad Oblast Justice of the Peace Court. And so when I looked into those data, I looked at what's really going on there. They have a huge, huge number of tax cases. And collection of petty debts by the tax authority is one of the categories that you can use for these judgments. And so it can be, to some extent, these numbers are dictated by what kinds of businesses are in the jurisdiction of these courts, that everyone would have some number of child custody, child support, alimony cases. But then if you had a lot of banks in your district, then perhaps you would have credit card collections in this. Now, the thing that's fascinating to me is the last column here. So that if you get, if you are the defendant in one of these cases and you receive in the mail your certificate of cost, and you think, well, I paid this debt or I don't owe this debt, then you can go right to the court, and you have to go pretty quickly, but you can go right to the court, and you don't have to prove anything. You just have to say, I don't agree with this. And then the case goes back to the plaintiff, and they have to decide whether they want to proceed with the hearing on the merits. And it all likely that they will, and then you go into the regular procedure. But you see here how few of these orders are challenged. So you see what an effective tool this is for case management, that it's a way for the courts to be able to handle a large number of cases. And for the most part, the judges themselves have very little to do with the sudebi prikazi. That the pomocniki, or if you don't have a pomocnik, the secretary would generally prepare the prikaz, and of course the judge signs it, the judge would use it, but these are foreign documents, so there isn't a lot of intellectual energy that goes into their preparation. And so here again, I bring this to your attention simply as a way of challenging the notion that of the victimhood of judges and their overworked status. Of course, this is a lot of paperwork, and that's a hassle, and it might be that there is a better way of handling this kind of procedure rather than forcing it to go through the courts. I think in some West European countries, there's a separate agency that deals with these kinds of things, and that might be a choice as well, because I think that sort of from an institutional point of view, if you use courts for non-judicial functions, which is more or less what you're doing here, then there's a tendency to have the legitimacy or the authority of the court weakened in that way. And so it might be interesting to think about that. But that's not a discussion that I heard anyone having in Russia at this time. So even if we take out all these cases, and it's, I'd like to be able to present to you now a picture of what it looks like once you pull out these cases, but it's almost impossible to do that. But I would give them that that they probably have an extraordinary workload, even if we take these out. But so let's talk about what the story is there. What explains the propensity of Russians to bring cases to the court? And here I'm really stepping back from the whole question of trust. And the paper that I'm not giving today makes an argument based on statistical evidence that trust is actually a relatively minor predictor of the use of courts, and that need and other kinds of indicators are more powerful. So let's look at other reasons why the number of cases might be so high in Russia. I think certainly as a U.S.-trained lawyer looking at this, one of the things that jumps out at you is the relatively low filing fees associated with going to court, the relatively rapid turnaround times. And I think this is something that the judges themselves and other court officials that I talked to fastened on as well, that they talked about how that there was really no reason not to go to court because for a lot of cases, it's literally cost-free. So there's no filing fee for a consumer rights case, for example. And for other cases, the filing fees are deliberately kept rather low. And I think this goes back to, I think here we see an intertwining of these narratives that I started with, that I think one of the reasons that they keep these filing fees so low is to maintain this idea that the courts are completely accessible and to try to go up against this notion that, you know, courts aren't trusted and that kind of thing. So I think it's a sort of a weird kind of feeding on each other, these various narratives. So the I say relatively low because I think for Russians, they often talk about how high they are. They often talk about how long it takes to get a case decided. But, you know, I feel like saying to them this phrase that you often hear in English, like, you should have our problems, right? Because to the time in which cases are decided in Russia, you know, you haven't even really gotten started in an adversarial system, right? Because we have this incredibly long, what we call a discovery or pretrial period, where we're sort of feeling each other out and exchanging evidence and all that kind of stuff. And that can sometimes go on for years, not just months. In fact, when I talk to judges, almost inevitably when they learn I'm American, their first question to me is, well, what are your deadlines? You know, Srok. And I say, well, we don't have that. And then they look at me as if I live in Disneyland, as if I live in some magical kingdom where there are no deadlines, right? And I try to explain that it is effective our judges work without accountability, but we simply don't have these kinds of rigid deadlines. You might say, well, why does anybody pay attention to these deadlines? And maybe it's your impression that they don't. But in fact, they do. They're obsessive about these deadlines. Statistics are kept. Statistics are paid attention to by the judges, and certainly paid attention to by their superiors. Many judges told me that they are routinely asked about every case in which they violate the deadline, asked to explain themselves, tell me tales of judges who were fired because they violated the deadline too many times. So this is a real problem. And adding to this is their desperate fear of being reversed, right? I think one of the most interesting distinctions that I see between Russia and just the conceptualization of judicial behavior in Russia and in the United States is this idea of a reversal as a mistake, right? Which is, it just seems to be the universal understanding of a reversal is that it's a mistake. It must be discussed, it must be explained, it must be fixed, and we must not do it again. I would talk to trial judges in the United States who talk about how proud they are of their reversals because they feel like they're taking a courageous stand. And that this is an important intellectual principle point that they're making. And this is absolutely not the understanding of Russian judges. And certainly also the question of the penalties, the informal penalties that come with reversals are relevant here. And why is this important to my interest in caseload? Well, one of the things that I observed is that when parties would show up and they are unprepared or they didn't bring the evidence or they cannot explain what they're doing there. So here I'm thinking of the plaintiff. In my world, the way I was trained, then you're done, right? We're done with you. If you can't show up on time with your evidence, then we don't have any interest in you. Russian judges do not take that position. They take the position that we want to give everybody an opportunity to fully air their argument. And if they're not ready on the day that we bring them in, well, we'll give them another chance. And another chance until the deadline, and then we become less forgiving, right? But the reason why they do that, because this is not what the procedural codes say they should be doing. And here we see a very interesting law on the books versus law in action kind of illustration. They do this because they believe that if they simply out of hand dismiss the case because someone shows up unprepared or without evidence, they will be summarily reversed. If the person appeals. Now, of course, they may be living in a fantasy world that the person would appeal, but they believe, and I think there are a number of reasons why they believe this, that if the person would appeal and say, I was reversed because I didn't have a chance to present my argument, the appellate judge would say, well, you really should have had that chance. Let's send it back. Or oftentimes, they will accept the evidence on appeal. In any event, it counts as a reversal for the judge, and so then they become very, very forgiving. And this then affects their ability to be able to handle this massive caseload. So then we ask the question, the eternal question in Russia. I guess there are two eternal questions. Что делать и кто виноват, right? So my question today is что делать, right? And I think the obvious solutions are probably politically infeasible. The obvious solutions, which many judges privately suggested to me, are to increase the filing fees, extend the deadlines. There are some people in the judicial apparatus that talk about this openly. Anton Ivanov is one that routinely talks about how the filing fee should be increased. But of course, he has a different audience. I think it's a different argument to talk about arbitrage courts where you're dealing with legal entities who are more capable, perhaps, of paying increased filing fees, although the arbitrage courts also deal with individual entrepreneurs who are less flush with money. But I think for the courts of general jurisdiction, it's a much trickier thing because one of their great claims to fame is that they really open their doors to everyone. And, of course, if you spend time in these justice of the peace courts, you realize that very few people are represented. That's yet another reason why the process can take longer than perhaps it should. And I think there's an overhang of the Soviet notion of the educational function of judges. So the judges reach out to work with the parties, always treading this very careful line between explaining what the law is and giving legal advice. They always feel like they're on the, you know, kind of the angel side of that, although it often seems to be like they very much veer over into basically telling the parties what to do, but I'm not sure what the alternative is. Now, one alternative would be to reform the rules to encourage and to require the use of lawyers. Now, the FATI are required for criminal cases, for criminal defendants, but not for any other type of case. And there's this very famous constitutional court case where they tried the original law on the African Torah, took a more strict position, and of course the constitutional court said that that was not okay. And I think that every judge I've talked to would like to have that rule in place. And the question really is how to dance around the concerns of the constitutional court. Because both the question of having representation and then having qualified representation and representation that can be disciplined if they're are not prepared or something like that, I think would help things along. And then, of course, the other option would be to simply do what we do in the United States with regard to our prison population. We just keep building more prisons, right? So in Russia, they could keep building more courthouses and hiring more judges. But at some point, just as we've discovered in the United States, you run out of money. We never run out of prisoners. We only run out of money. And so here, I think it's been very interesting to watch the building of courthouses, and there was a need to build new courthouses. But I think maybe we've run out of those budgetary funds and now need to look within, need to figure out how to create more incentives within the system. So what kind of institutional reforms might be put into place? One idea is to encourage the greater use of alternative dispute resolution, including mediation. And this is another thing that I spent time looking at when I was in Russia last year, and I have a separate paper on that that's also available on SSRN if you're interested. But the bottom line is that mediation has been a very, very slow to take hold, and it's not clear that it is going to take hold in Russia. And despite what the judicial officialdom thought when they first introduced the law on mediation at the beginning of 2011, mediation is not really the way to deal with an overwhelming caseload. Mediation takes time, and it's really best in handling complicated factual disputes, complicated emotional disputes. So family members, former business partners, neighbors, that kind of thing. It's not going to clear your caseload, right? So that probably is not the best way to handle things. There is a draft law circulating out there that was, I think, prepared by the Higher Arbitrage Court and signed on to by the Council of Judges that would allow pomocniki to handle pretrial hearings. Now, I think the problem there is that showing up for these pretrial hearings would not be mandatory. And one of the things that I think the arbitrage courts discovered is when they introduced the idea of pretrial hearings, most parties just simply didn't show up because they weren't mandatory. And whether or not this would work is very much open to question. And whether or not parties would pay any attention to what this permanent clerk or pomocnik said is also unclear. The pomocniki tend to be younger people, often women, and the level of respect that they hold among litigants is unclear. Oftentimes, there are people who are dreaming of becoming judges. There's also a very high turnover among this group because they're desperately underpaid and overworked. So they really only hang on if they are interested in becoming a judge. And so whether they would have the experience necessary to be able to handle these hearings in a way that would build respect is unclear. A more intriguing idea is the idea of authorizing kind of premium payments if you're a judge or also for the staff if you're handling what is considered to be an unreasonable caseload. Now, interestingly, this is something that the Higher Arbitrage Court proposed, but the Council of Judges would not sign on to. This was too controversial for them. But it is an interesting idea to kind of hit the state in the pocketbook and say, you know, here you're going to pay for this. If you want us to work this hard, then you have to pay us more. So a very interesting idea. And then, of course, my personal idea, which no one is interested in, is that you would actually create incentives that would encourage judges to pay attention to the procedural rules and dismiss cases when they are either there's really nothing going on there, or the parties show up empty-handed or show up without the evidence that they need to prove their case. The last thing is to perhaps expand mechanisms for accelerated resolution of cases. I don't think this is really an issue for the courts of general jurisdiction. The Tsujimi Prikazi is already that kind of system, and they've sort of already maximized that. They might be able to identify other types of cases that would benefit from this. But the arbitrage courts could use this. Now, as those of you who are familiar with the arbitrage procedure code will know, they did put something like this into the 2002 code. And here we see some data on how it was used. And so this is this idea of upraschonit razvodstva. And so, in fact, there's some really lovely quotes from Yakovlev at the time this was put in. And he saw this is the answer to our problems. This is the way that we're going to be able to deal with this massive overflow of cases, which was a problem, has been a perennial problem for the courts. And so we see that it got a slow start, but an interesting start in some. There's quite a lot of regional variation in terms of how well it was embraced. And we see, though, that almost irrespective of how it started, it has drastically tailed off, so that it's now almost never used, right? And I think there's some interesting regional stories here. I happened to spend some time in Olmsk in around 2002, and the chairman, the woman who was the chairman then, was a great cheerleader for this idea and really thought that it was the answer. And so not surprisingly, her judges followed suit and handled a lot of cases in that way. And then she retired and got somebody new who was not such a fan, and it goes away. So why has it not been embraced? I think that the reason, and I have another paper on this question, an older paper, but the reason I think lies in the wording of the law, that it requires the judges, it allows the judges to use this procedure if the case is bis fornem, so if the case has no real dispute at hand. But who decides whether it's bis fornem? Right? The judges and this is also a great contrast to the way kind of I was brought up, but judges are reluctant to take initiative or reluctant to use this discretion that they have. And basically, they have to decide whether or not the defendant is going to challenge, right? Because they're saying that by using this procedure, they're saying, well, the defendant is basically not going to put up a defense. And so if the defendant rises up into action, then they have to set the case for a full hearing and risk violating the deadline, right? So the safe thing to do is just simply set the case for a hearing on the merits and just run through the usual steps. And if nobody shows up, nobody shows up. You just kind of go through this empty procedure, which is why oftentimes there's a long list of cases and very few human bodies in the courtroom. So this makes it much safer. But of course, all of that is paperwork, and much more paperwork than the Tsujimi Prikazi, because you have to set the case for hearing, you have to send out the opravdanie, you have to do all of this kind of rigmarole that goes with judicial hearings. So the good news is that the Higher Arbitrage Court has a draft that's already been sent to the Duma that is looking to revitalize upraschonit razvodstva. And they looked at what had happened and tried to figure out how they could incentivize judges to use this more. And basically, they tried to remove the discretion. They said that for any case that is less than 100,000 rubles, you must use the Lashon Hara Prezvosa. Right? So that will take a lot of cases off the table for full hearings and put them, make them more likely Sudebi Pekazi. And I don't mean to imply for the people here who are experts on procedure that these are identical processes, but they are analogous. And so whether this will be adopted, what effect it will have, that remains to be seen. But I think it is a very encouraging step for the courts. And there are other categories of cases, a number of administrative types of cases that would be handled in this way as well. And then we also might look at institutional reforms, or I'm sorry, cultural or ways of approaching cases, kinds of reforms. And one of the things that I think is very interesting to me as I observe cases, and certainly as I look at the statistics, is the lack of the propensity to settle cases in Russia. And I think this goes back to the low filing fees, the quick turnaround times. But I'm also often really amazed at the fact that when I go to a court and I start watching the parties, that it's apparent that they have not actually talked to each other before they came to court. That they simply file these papers, they show up, they deal with it there, that's that. And that's a luxury that people in adversarial systems that are much more expensive don't have. And so as a result, when you look at the statistics for U.S. courts in particular, and you look at if you would take 100% of cases, civil cases that are filed, and you look at the percentage that actually end up having a decision, it's about 2 or 3%, right? And everything else goes away through settlement or some other ways that the parties resolving things on their own. And of course, the way that we teach lawyers reflects this, that we spend a lot of time in law schools talking about settlement processes and why it's important to settle and how that helps build a relationship with a client, all kinds of things like that, which seems to be, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but seems to be absent in Russian legal education, and maybe it's just beginning. And so as a result, what you see is a relatively small percentage of cases, certainly a very small percentage that are resolved through an actual mirovaya soglashenie, you know, so a settlement agreement. There are more cases that probably fall into this category because the plaintiff simply withdraws the claim, right? So that's perhaps another 10% or so that disappear in that way. But even so, that's a relatively small number of cases. Now, all of the procedural codes have language in them that encourages judges to tell the parties about their opportunity to settle, their opportunity to use alternative dispute resolution. But judges, and one of the things that I think is worth looking at and studying, which I haven't done yet in more detail, is the kind of the attitude of judges towards this, that you can follow the letter of the law. You can say to the parties, well, you have a right to do this, this, and this. But you can say it in such a way that it's very clear that, you know, yes, this exists on paper, but, you know, it's not really our problem. Or you can do it in a way that does encourage people to think about this. That's a very subtle difference. And I think one that it perhaps maybe even has a generational tint to it, and probably is influenced by the attitude of the chairman of the courts, right? So if the chairman is pro-settlement and pro-ADR, and a good example of this would be Katerinburg, where Arina Reshetnikova is the chair of the cassation court there, and is very, very keen on these kinds of procedures. And the numbers show that people have, she's provided, well, it's not just that people are kind of wanting to please her, it's also that she's provided a great deal of training for judges about the different skills that go along. Because there is a certain skill attached to trying to encourage parties to think about resolving the case on their own. Maybe a different tone of voice, maybe a different attitude, not the kind of top-down approach that judges typically use in their daily running of the courtroom, which they need. They need to have that authoritative tone. So that's a kind of a bigger question about the whole culture of settlement in Russia. So just to conclude, I think that it's fair to say that there are a lot of things going on here in terms of why you have so many cases and so many kind of unimportant and petty cases coming to the courts. And as I said before, this may be something that settles out on its own, right? We're really observing a very short period here from the end of the Soviet Union until now, And in some ways, the increase in the number of cases being filed is a good indicator, because it would suggest somewhat differently than the public opinion polls that maybe there is some, at least, toleration of what the courts are doing, right? That it, you can't be contemptuous of the courts and still file claims there, unless you're forced into it, as in a criminal case, or perhaps because you need a divorce. But I think what's fair to say is that this notion, this image of courts as being wide open, as being open to all, is part of the sort of reason for being of these courts. That when you read interviews with Lebedev or Ivanov or anyone in the higher parts of the court administration, they're very, very proud of this idea that, that justice is available to all. And also, to go back to this point that I've been somewhat harping on, this idea that I think they should be quicker to dismiss cases, that's also something that they say, they talk about, except to the exact opposite of my point. Yakovlev in particular often talks about how proud he is of the fact that their courts are committed to having a full airing of the case, which is how he defines justice, right? I've heard that a lot from other judges. When I tell them about the American experience, they're deeply horrified at the idea that you would push these people out of court before they had a right to tell their story. And so it's just, now we're back to cultural and, tinged by institutional incentives, factors. So the bottom line here, though, seems to be that even though it's possible an economist can come in here and tell you exactly how to stop these cases coming in, they would set the price so high. I mean, any of us that have taken introductory economics know those curves, right? And we just need to find the point on that curve where you're going to have your sweet spot. But the political will to do that just seems to be lacking in Russia. And so I think that they'll have to deal with this. And I think the biggest problem is that when you're dealing with this massive quantity of cases, the quality of the judging just cannot be as good as it would be if you had a bit more time to deal with the cases. So I'll stop with that and open it up for questions.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Questions.
I guess we need a microphone.
Yes, you're good. Thank you.
Okay. Where should I use my things? Right. Okay. Yeah. We have a first one from the PMJ.
Speaker Wallace. I think you have missed one point, which for me, as participant of the system, is very important. It's a low qualification of jobs. First, they have most very good education. Mostly, they are former secretary of their court. Mm-hmm. So, the question is, what is their education? As a rule, it's a second education. So, 2 years of training after technical or other education they have to learn and prepare. And another thing is, it's the general jurisdiction and no specialization. So, a general jurisdiction judge is a specialist in tax cases, housing cases, weather cases, family cases, and everything. So, you understand, it's not possible. And my feeling that when a case is postponed, when I appear before the judge, well, with full hands of evidence, she needs to think it over, and it's mainly for this reason that the case is postponed. Also in Canada, that's because the specialization of the commercial judges is rather an exception than a rule. They are doing civil cases, tax cases, administrative cases, everything. So, in my opinion, the main problem with access to good educational basis in Russia is so where of professionalization of our judges.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a very interesting point, but of course it doesn't really go to the question of why there's so many cases, right? As someone coming from an Anglo-American system, I am not at all troubled by the lack of specialization, because of course our judges generally are not specialized, and we don't really see that as a problem. And I spent a lot of time in courts, and to be honest, and I think this is, I don't quite know how to say this, but I've seen more problems with low qualifications of lawyers than low qualifications of judges, right? I've seen more problems with lawyers who really provide no value added to the process and are being paid to be there. And I'm sure you're a great lawyer, and I'm sure you do a great job. But of course, in a lot of the cases that come to the Justice and Peace Courts, there are no lawyers, there are no representatives at all. Now, as to whether or not the judges could be better trained, I don't disagree with that, and I think that I think maybe this afternoon, are you going to present data from that study or not? Okay. Yeah, so we'll hear a little bit more about the background of judges, and I agree with you that almost every judge that I interacted with, and I always ask them what their background was, almost all of them had come out of the judicial system, so almost all of them had been secretaries and commissioners. And a lot of them had actually done their law school training while they were working there, which I think is no longer allowed. And so this does lead you to question how good their law training is. And it does lead to somewhat of an incestuous system where all they know is the court system. They don't really understand it. And I think that's something that, coming from an Anglo-American system, is strikes me as odd, but I don't think it's so odd when you look at it in terms of other civil law systems. I think that one of the things that it does do is it gives them a very clear understanding of how to manage their caseload and how to move cases along. That's really the only thing they know how to do, is coming from being secretaries and promotion. But I don't disagree with your main point that judges could be better educated, but I have to say that I did not see, and I watched hundreds of cases, I did not see very many cases where the reason why it was postponed was so that the judge could look at the evidence. Almost always it was because the parties did not show up prepared or didn't show up at all. So,
okay. Oh, just a very...
do you need a microphone?
I don't know if I need a microphone. On your last point about, what was it, about there being a culture against going to judgment without a hearing, I wonder, I mean, this is wild speculation, but within the criminal justice system, with the, as it were, growth and increase of yeah, whatever you want to call it, plea bargaining, whether that will, might just make, you know, help change the culture.
Yeah, I think the question of this Asobi Pariyatam, that's been a very interesting thing to observe, and Peter Solomon has written a very interesting paper on this. And the question of whether that will lead over into civil cases, I just don't know. I mean, it's a somewhat specialized area, and given that, I guess it could, if the avvocati that are involved take this up and see if this could be valuable. But one of the problems...
Well, I think so, different idea of what justice...
Right.
Involved.
Yeah. But of course, a lot of people that are representing the clients in these Asobi Pariyatam cases are there just for the 600 rubles that you get for the state representation. And if you're representing the clients in a civil case and you're an avocat and you don't expect to ever see them again, then it's in your interest to have as many hearings as possible because that's how you get paid, right? And that's a very different, I mean, in a way, it's not an entirely different incentive structure than what we're used to in Western cultures, but I think in the West we're always thinking about how can we retain that client. And I in the focus groups that I've done with lawyers, they're never thinking about that. And so with lawyers in Russia, you know, they don't seem to be thinking in that sort of way. And that gives you, that leads you to have a very different way of interacting with your clients.
So thank you, Catherine, for your rich presentation, but I have more general comment which has to do with the cultural and political dimension of conflict resolution, because I started to think while listening to you, the report I was writing with my colleagues and some judges and so on, when we were sitting in a committee in 2003 evaluating the Finnish court procedure. And we had quite many discussions on the role of alternative dispute resolution and mediation, or how much we should encourage justice to be active in settlement or party settlement, and so on. And we had actually two two main schools or ideas in discussing about that. And somehow I maybe was one of the the conservative ones, which is quite astonishing, because I wanted to point out that it's still very important in our culture to point out the role of courts, that the courts somehow have to be in the center of conflict resolution, and that we still have this idea that when the court are doing their work, they are somehow taking care of law, and the law is coming from through legislation and so on. And the other school may be pointing more about more fairness or justice, which you can always discuss about. But it would be, of course, optimal resolution, optimal idea in a small country, actually, but also in a bigger country, that law and justice are somehow very near with each other. And I think that it would be optimal to have a functioning courts to stay or apply law, but also taking care of justice. So I see it more as a political and cultural question, so that not automatically recommend people to use alternative dispute resolution, because it's also theoretically, it's not maybe a legal solution, it's something more. And then we somehow agree that we can have so many ideas of justice also in a society. And I could see that maybe in Russia, which is somehow legal in a just transition phase, it would be important to point out maybe the role of the courts and their role or their quality or the quality of decision making and so on. But it was more of a general comment. And the other comment is somehow almost the same, and it's of course it has something to do with the legal theory. Because I think in the Nordic countries and as a European continent, we also think that somehow law is maybe something we can agree about. So that we even think time to time that only one right resolution is possible in certain cases. And it's again something which has to do with the continental legal theory and so on. As it's an old fashioned way to think about law, but still we have this tendency to think also in that, which you don't have for every, as far as I can understand, in the US American legal system.
Well, let me just respond to your comment about mediation, because as I say, I thought a lot about mediation, and I think the parties on a superficial level are exactly in your camp. Mm-hmm. That when and I like you, I'm a little bit troubled by the idea of judges encouraging people to use mediation. I really think it should be the parties that decide that this is what they want to do. But because in Russia they aren't aware of this, then the judges become the ones that educate them a little bit about this. But the attitude of a lot of parties when they come to court is basically that if we thought we could do this on our own, we wouldn't be here, right? So you do it. That's what. Why are you asking us about this, right? But the dilemma, I think, and the reason why in certain cases it seems like mediation can be very helpful is that oftentimes you have cases where the legal question is only a very small part of the actual problem, and mediation allows you to get at this broader problem. And otherwise, and many judges told me about this, that you know it can often happen in an inheritance case or neighbors, or they just keep coming back. You resolve this question, but you haven't really solved the problem. So then they're back with another case. And so then you have an efficiency argument at play. But that is not a way of clearing the caseload. Right? It almost goes back to anthropological ideas of societal harmony. Right? And that this would be a way of maintaining in small communities societal harmony, because there are lots of cases where you don't necessarily want to have a clear winner and a clear loser, right? Family law would be a great example of that. Yeah.
Thanks for a very illuminating presentation. I recall somehow that if you analyze relationships between Russian judges and Russian litigants, but say between Russian medical doctors and their patients, you will find somewhat strikingly similar picture of avalanche of cases, number of petty claims, like called, also transferring responsibilities from doctors to nurses who do routine signatures in order to fulfill these claims. Also, some rules about deadlines, reversal of cases, and so on and so forth. There are two questions. First, whether or not there is some sort of peculiarity of legal arena, or judicial arena, or everything you analyzed might be framed within the general pattern of behavior of bureaucracy, whatever in medicine or in legal arena or somewhere else. The second question is related to your conclusion about the lack of political will to restrict access to courts. Again, if you compare with access to medicine, free medicine public, you will find striking difference, because whatever the Russian state do is aimed to pose some entry barriers to guarantee minimal standard, which means that for everything else you have to pay, and so on. So, what explains this striking difference in medical arena and in legal arena? In other words, why do Russian state try to minimize access of patients to medicine, but not access of, access of litigants to courts? Thank you.
Well, that's a fascinating question, and I confess I had literally never thought about it in that way. I think one of my knowledge about medical things is limited only to anecdotal evidence through my friends. And to be honest, I've always thought that the Russian government was trying to steer people away from doctors that the state provides and almost force them into using doctors that you have to pay for in order to... And I don't know all the reasons why. I don't know the politics of that. But I think that makes it a very profound difference between the legal arena and the medical arena, is that for courts, there are alternatives to courts. But there are Tretiansky Sudy, there are now mediation, but people don't use them, right? Whereas it's my understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected, that an awful lot of people do make use of doctors that they have to pay for, rather than waiting around for the state's sponsored doctors. So I think that's one big difference. But I'm very intrigued by the idea, and if you can point me to some literature on the medical side of things, I'd be very grateful.
Mm-hmm. I should want to thank you for a very illuminating talk. About a year ago, I went with some colleagues to a court session in Moscow, and you were sitting at the front of it taking notes.
Oh,
and afterwards, my
in Moscow City Arbitration Court.
Yes. My colleague was saying, well, why was Americans sitting there speaking to that Russian? I'm very excited to tell them about your paper. I wanted to come to your point about settlement and the fact that lawyers don't seem to be talking to each other before they come to court. My observation is that probably is true in Moscow City. Can't say about other cities, but I have observed working with my Russian colleagues that there is no sense of collegiality towards lawyers from other law firms or representing opposing clients. Almost as if the lawyer representing an opposing party are deeply associated. And it is true that sometimes the parties are represented either by their in-house counsel or even by persons who aren't lawyers. But it's quite disturbing to me as an Anglo-American lawyer watching this, because, as you know, in the United States and England, there is an expectation that lawyers do get on, that they talk to each other about small logistical or administrative matters before walking into court. And maybe that's something you could also look into at some point.
Well, what you say is deeply discouraging to me, because I have had this mini hypothesis that law firms like yours would be different, right? Because certainly when I was talking, and I don't think I had a chance to interview anybody from your firm, but I interviewed people from other major Western law firms, and it's clear that they are just qualitatively different than the average jurista or avvocati in someplace like Holmes, or, you know, you're just, first of all, you have a different category of clients. And then I had hypothesized that maybe, you know, you would be embrace some of the ideas that you identified from the United States and the UK in terms of interacting with colleagues. And so I see that it's very interesting to see that, that even there, it doesn't seem to quite hold. But I guess my question for you, and we can talk about this afterwards, it just seems to me that there's a certain efficiency that comes with having that minimal colleagueship, you know, but...
If I may ask a question as well, since I'm chair of the, you know, like, from my beloved. I just have a couple of things on your points connected to the dismissal cases and why the story of the litigant should be heard by the judge and why, because there's an orientation and forwards here in the stories. And, well, it's a new study based on what I said yesterday, that Russian history doesn't explain anything, but you can't really use, you know, culture to actually explain things which are happening. That's precisely what Russian history, as well as litigation culture, is quite relevant to what's happening in the courtroom. The same thing as with the patients and doctors, actually, in medicine, is there are several important things which we have to look at why the story should be heard, as my own research is in litigation cases in 17th and 18th centuries. And from the cases, you can see that the judge who does not hear the story or dismisses the story, of course, the litigation is absolutely different than the 17th century, but the assessment of the judge, who is the just judge, or who is the efficient judge, it's not the judge who actually rules the case according to the law. It's actually the judge who gives you the opportunity to lay out your case. You know, and because it was adversary system back then in lots of the cases, and the inquisitorial system was slowly coming in, and it was such a handful of criminal cases, so all the criminal cases went to the adversary system, actually it was extremely important for litigants, not to court, actually, to lay out the story, and then the court served as a mediation room for them to meet. It was not extra. Judicial activity is actually their legal activity for them to do, and I see a great continuation in this with the a little bit discontinuity during the Soviet times, where, although it was important to have a story in court, but you really have to be very careful as to what you say in court or in the public generally. So today, I think we're having this massive compensation for people, coming to court and actually wanting to lay out their story, even not thinking about the consequences of the case. They start thinking about that, but a bit later, when they, laid out the story, and then the second step, instead of thinking for this in advance, they start thinking, okay, what should I get from that, and what's going to be the outcome? And then, of course, the judgment or the ruling could be something absolutely different from what they want the both parties want. And that the ruling actually could be dissatisfying to both parties, and then you have appeal, and then here there is a certain culture of appeal, you have thing. So I think in this particular case, we have to look at a certain any development of this litigation culture within the courtroom and the courtroom as this community, space, for all the disciplines. And the hierarchy in the courtroom, and of course, gender is very important. Who comes by, blah blah blah. So I think this might be something very potentially interesting, in a way, if you try to kind of explain what's going on. Mm-hmm. But of course, and the second point, connects to that, which again is connected. Why not to use mediation? Why not to use extrajudicial activity? So why lawyers don't agree on certain things? Why there are no lawyers? Which is like a fascinating thing, of course, from the anti-American point of view. But of course, the access to justice is something the state should guarantee in a way to pretend, at least, that they take kind of care of people, although we have this certain mistrust and whatever discourses are going on, that we trust or we don't trust, etc. But you said that the trust is actually has very little relevance to whether I go to court or not. But that's precisely precisely the point that people go to court because they trust the judge and the system, because there is a huge need to go to court for certain reasons, and that because there is this accessible justice, and we all say that justice should be accessible, again, the litigated culture is that we pursue the justice as the right we should exercise, and precisely in the past couple of years, this right to go to court to combat the government or to, you know, to claim political cases or something is perceived as the way we can actually change what's going on. And it has nothing to do with the trust. It's something, but it's like a formal way of trying to change, you know, the system. Although everybody's a pessimist saying that, okay, the outcome is bad, but it's an outcome because it's a bad outcome. And, you know, in a way, when it goes with the quantity and quality, and it'll five generations, whatever generations. But it's actually an interesting attitude as well, in terms of the discourse, you know, a discussion among people, not necessarily lawyers, but just the general public. Why?
Right.
You know, we'd rather go to court than we, you know, use mediation, for example, that my school of law trains those mediators, and they're absolutely useless. I mean, why do we do that?
Well, that's interesting. One of the most interesting parts of the whole mediation story is there's an incredible demand for training as a mediator, but yet no case is mediated. So that's a little bit of that would definitely be a puzzle for an economist. But let me just go on to your other comments, if you don't mind. I really love that point about the coming from the 17th and 18th century about the community of the courtroom. But I think also we need to lay in the educational function that comes out of the Soviet period. So I think all those taken together. But it doesn't address, you know, why it is that people just don't show up and how they expect that the court's going to wait around for them. You know, I'm with you if they come. And I think different judges have different kinds of attitudes, different levels of patience. I mean, one of the things I've always been struck by is the level of patience of these judges is they listen to these endless stories. And I think there's a real difference in the level of patience of in the Justice of the Peace courts as compared to the arbitrage courts, where they have comparatively less patience for this sort of thing. But as to the question of voided court, I think one of the most interesting things is this is the you know, access to justice is typically given as a part of rule of law, right? But of course, because the West has much lower levels of access to justice. We talk about, I think Jane would support me on this, that the US and the UK talk endlessly about how accessible our system is. But it isn't, right? It costs a lot. The procedural rules are so complicated that no one without specialized legal training, I would not represent myself in court, right? And so so it's really quite poorly accessible. And if we would reorient the importance of the different factors in the rule of law index, then all of a sudden countries would look different. But because, and this is very cynical, because the West doesn't do so well in access to justice, it's a minimal part of rule of law, right? And I think it's very interesting that that Russia has maintained this attitude. But your point about the importance of thinking that going to court is a way of interacting with the state, I mean, I don't think that's different than certainly the United States, and I think the UK as well, that the idea is, and we have this long history of test cases and going to court simply to prove points, even though you know you're going to lose, and gradually wearing them down. So I'm not sure that the gradually wearing them down part has worked in Russia as well as it has in the United States, but it took a long time in the United States, too. So we'll see.
You know, 5 generations ago.
Yeah.
Speaking about access to justice in Russian Federation, I want you to hear the opinion of the speaker of the fact that today we have observed via internet court hearings in Russian Federation. It means that, for example, on Monday I was sitting in Tampere in my office and via internet I observed how was going on one case in Supreme Arbitration Court in Russian Federation.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Arbitrage Court is really a leader in this. And if anyone has insomnia, then you can go to YouTube and you can watch the Supreme Arbitrage Court all night. Right? Not live, but they put everything online, which is fantastic. And they have really taken this Law 262, this obligation to modernize and to become accessible through the internet. Much further than the courts of general jurisdiction. Now, they're a smaller court, they're more specialized courts, so maybe it's easier. And they've also been quite proactive in the area of electronic filing, which I think is very interesting.
When I talk to people at the courts of general jurisdiction, you know, their heads just exploded when I talked to them about this idea that, you know, could people file claims electronically? Well, how would we verify who they are? How would we know that their signature is real? Well, I don't know how you know it when they send it in the mail.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, that's okay. So I think that it's a mindset. But I think you're, and also in the, and I'm not in the arbitrage courts. I don't think it's true in the justice of peace courts. It might be true in higher level courts in the general jurisdiction system. They can have people participate in the hearings electronically. I think I remember reading that the prisoners can participate. I think, Anton, I thought I remembered reading Romanova's husband, that memoir that she wrote, that he was able to be in his arraignment electronically, right, which isn't a real great way of participating. But in arbitrage cases, they'll often have people that are in far-flung areas come in rather than making them come all the way to the court. They will beam them in on the screen. So. But that's a budget question, too, in terms of equipping the courtrooms with that kind of technology. And I think, as a general rule, the arbitrage courts are much better equipped than the courts of general jurisdiction.
If you allow, I have a short comment on my own. So, because this is also the finest way to understand legal history or which courts or during 16th, 17th, and even 18th century, that the most important was the participation and the discussion about the law. But then we have a period, then we got a period so with a very passive way of discussion about law, and it was the authoritative judge, and everyone trusted that he knows the law, and the law was written in the legislation. But now, again, we have a new phase or a new stage, and this is a stage of ideology of participation. And now, since 1990s, we have had big reforms going on in our court system and in our constitution. So we are pointing out that the most important point of acceptance is that parties can participate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is then the trend towards after redistribution, erosion, mediation, and so on. So, and I personally think that this is the right way, because at the moment, so if you get people convinced that it's important to participate, that you have a right to be heard, and so on, you have maybe a better legitimacy or acceptance also when the judiciary is concerned.
Right. Right. I don't know whether everyone's familiar with it, but there's this wonderful book by Tom Tyler called Why People Obey the Law, and he takes this point about, I think he calls it procedural justice, and then people believe that the process is fair, then they're more likely to go along with the outcomes, even if they individually disagree with the outcome, that they're not going to become violent about it or anything like that. And I think it's an argument that I've struggled with how exactly to apply to Russia, but I think it's a very important hypothesis in socio-legal scholarship.
Just another thing of I use another concept in my research, participation in court hearings as an entertainer. There is a lot of cultural studies about that, legal cultural studies
right.
about that. And I think that in the courts, especially the, you know, the peace courts,
right.
the courts of peace, the general jurisdiction courts, I mean, arbitration is not entertaining, I'm pretty sure.
What's entertaining to me?
Yeah, the researcher, but not to the participants, although I think there is a thing to that. But many people who go with fake claims, especially with fake claims, like, my neighbor snores,
right.
and I cannot do anything about that. And that's a typical case you bring
right.
to an arbitration of peace. And there is a sheer entertainment for many of them to participate
right.
and in it, because the outcome can be anything, that could be a fine or whatever, they channel the need to interact with the state, but also to a certain way
right.
to entertain a public, entertain a you know,
right.
concept, to participate as entertaining as in the system.
Yeah.
And that's quite interesting because I think America started this research in the 70s, but you know, with special test cases, trying to theorize. You know, this they thought new culture coming, but of course, it's
historians, the medieval legal historians especially, pointed out that again, back to, you know, 16th and 17th century, all the wars at theatre where, you know, people, especially for the big cases,
right,
people would show up to participate in the whole theatre and get entertained, because, I mean, of sex crime cases is the most entertaining thing you can get.
Yeah.
Well, there's got other nice cases like you know, Bestiali cases, for example, in Sweden, and there was research on that. So, in a way, it was also, I mean, what was the sort of information, it was a source of entertainment, and these days, I think these functions of information and entertainment and education is still there, which is in a different world, and there's an internet, you know, kind of a participation in it. Again, there's the enlightening function, but also informational education function, which is there, and the kind of being strictly legal about that, forget about the bigger sociocultural picture beyond, you know, the strict assessing, you know, whatever is coming forward, it's just legal matter.
Well, you mentioned that paper that I have in the volume from the European University, and in that paper I was reporting or analyzing focus groups on Vermont, and there was a guy in there that had been to court, he's a pensioner, he'd been to court 15 times, and that was what he did for a living, you know, and he loved it, and he was fabulous in the focus groups. He was basically, you know, explaining to other people how contract law works and whatever, and he had been the subject of an article in RBMT Boxing. You know, he was, and judges often talk about, old, especially older people, coming in as a way to continue to connect with someone. So, and there, and even more than judges, the staffs of judges will talk about how, you know, older people will come in and really what they're looking for is somebody to talk to, right? But your point about going to court as, you know, sort of entertainment reminds me of my dad. My dad grew up in the South, and he used to tell me that it was very hot in the South, and that in the days before air conditioning, he and his friends would go into the courthouse and it would be a marble building, nice and cool, and they would watch the cases because it would be fun.
Yeah.
But the sad thing about Russian courts is that even though the Constitution says that they're open to all, it's not always easy to go in, and this is changing, but in a lot of places, they don't have courtrooms, and so you're watching cases in the office of the judge, which, you know, complicates my life, and because then it becomes more difficult for me to get access. But also, I think, makes it almost impossible for someone to come in and just be an observer. Although, anytime, you know, you mentioned that your colleagues asked what I was doing there, a lot of times they'll ask the judge, like, who the hell is this? You know, what's she doing here? And in cases that have any, whether the person has a kind of a persecution complex or it's actually an important case, they'll assume like someone from the press or someone from the other side, someone there to get a compromise from them or something like that. And they'll, sometimes they'll explain who I am, but oftentimes they'll just say, you know, the Constitution says that these hearings are open and this is someone who wants to listen and, you know, shut up.
So, can I just say, you gave a wonderful argument for bringing back Comrades Court. Yeah. Let's have, we'll just have specifically for people to...
Don't you think the function of Comrades Courts are now fulfilled by Chastity? When my students read the you know, that chapter out of George Piper's book on Comrades Courts, they'll say, well, this is Judge Judy. You know, or this is a program in the United States with a judge, you know, resolving petty cases.
Yeah, well, that's another type of thing to say.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's been all, you know, going about in terms of mass media studies, the specific, you know, from our performance where you have the chance to die, you know, Jeff Dooney and whatever.
Yeah.
Of course, well, my students are usually quite frustrated once they learn the procedure and they realize that it's all not, what's really happening in the courtroom. They all kind of see the
faces
starting critiquing it and saying, why? Who watches these programs?
Yeah.
Somebody does.
Yeah, I love that.
Okay,
any other comments on that question? Okay, Mr. Kahn. Quite significant.
Yeah.
I would like to return to the question about ADR. We know now the picture from the Finnish perspective. I myself have attended a meeting in Russia. And I think that ADR in Russia has two facets. It is still a matter of fashion, first of all, not a widespread social practice. And the second point is that it is a matter of business, unfortunately. And this scheme looks like that, for example. A psychologist is a true story. This is a true story. Make up a sort of courses in VGR at some university. Then they invite all sorts of people, lawyers with the academic background, of course. And then these people become certificates that they are AVR experts. And it costs lots of money for these people. And I think that by this practice, the idea may be compromised for the AVR altogether. And what's your opinion? My question is that there are two trends in Russia. One trend supports the idea of the federal law on aviation, which invites all sorts of people to participate in this process, with academic background, of course. And the other trend is more German-like, that only professionals, only professional lawyers may do this business. What's your opinion? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think you have put your finger on the samis vorni vopros. That when you go to a conference with people who study mediation, everybody dreads the moment when somebody brings up this question, you know, who should be a mediator? Because everybody, no matter what your background is, you feel like you would be the best to do it. And there is this, there, in different parts of Russia, different groups have evolved that specialize in mediation. In St. Petersburg, there is this group from the Cathedral of Conflictology that are mostly psychologists that pursue it. And then in Yekaterinburg, there is this group of more law-based people. And then in Moscow, as I understand it, the people there are just interested in money, right? So the point is that I'm not sure that, I think it will have to work itself out in Russia to see who gets legitimized in terms of what qualities you need. And it seems to me it might depend on the type of dispute, right? That it would seem to me that I know that the group in St. Petersburg has an arrangement with the office that deals with problems between parents and children, right? And these would be pre-court disputes. And it seems to me like there maybe a psychologist would be a useful background to deal with those kinds of disputes. But that if you're talking about someone snoring or a dog barking or that kind of thing, then maybe a lawyer is the better person, the better background to have. I actually, and this is really kind of stakhanovite work that I did here, participated in two different trainings for mediators. One was a type that was incredibly expensive, and I thought was completely useless. And the other was relatively inexpensive. I didn't pay for any of them, but I knew what the cost would have been. And the other one was relatively inexpensive and was designed more for law types, right? And so I think that you're right, that there's a market developing and a lot of dissension, a lot of disagreement among people about how you should go about training people. There was, I think, a lot of dissension over the program that was adopted by the Department of the Ministry of Education over how you train people, that it was absurd to require 120 hours to make someone a mediator, and that was designed simply to allow people to charge a lot of money for it. Now, the puzzle to me is why people are flocking to these trainings, right? I don't understand it. If there was a big market for mediation, then perhaps then it's a way to earn extra income. But when I was in these trainings and would talk to the people about why they were there, none of them had any idea that they would actually be working as mediators. They would talk about how they simply wanted to learn these skills. And the skill is about how to work with people. And we need more people like that in the world, and certainly in Russia we need more people like that, so that's a good thing. But I don't know what's going to happen with mediation. It seems to me that in most countries where it has taken hold not because it was out there and people suddenly discovered it and started doing it. It took hold because it became mandatory in a certain category of cases. People had to go through it. Not that they necessarily had to resolve disputes through mediation, they simply had to go through that stage in order to get to court, and then discovered that, hey, there's something useful to this, and then word of mouth builds. But I don't see that happening in if it's always voluntary, and if it's expensive. Because not only is training expensive, having a mediator is expensive. And the thing that's fascinating to me is that in a number of places in Russia, and in Pskov, in Yekaterinburg, and St. Petersburg, there were actual funded programs where the cost of mediation was assumed by the funder. And even then, they couldn't get people to do it, right? So if it's actually free and they don't want to take advantage of it, then surely when it becomes expensive, then they're not going to take advantage of it. So it's a puzzle. And I think it's a big puzzle for Russia because, you know, we think from anthropological work that Russians prefer to do things in a more informal way. And certainly in my own work, in some of the focus group research and that kind of thing, I've seen a lot of examples where people are essentially going through mediation, except not the way the federal law requires it. But the essence of mediation is you go to a trusted third party to resolve your problem. And, you know, I have this paper where I look at how people resolve problems when water leaks into their apartments, you know, which I think is a fairly common problem in Russia. And a lot of, very few people went to court over this, and a lot of people would go to a third party to say, well, who do you think is right here? And so I had thought, well, when you formalize this a little bit, it should be very, very popular. And yet, as you point out, it's not. And I don't know that that's going to change. So.
Well,
right.
One
last, you know, short comment
from another topic. So, when I was using the term alternative disinterested return, it was used very loosely. So, because I mean everything, so which happens outside the court room, and this is also the Finnish way to talk about that. So, and we have traditionally quite many boards, so small organs. As for instance, for consumer companies and so on, which we also can categorize as dispute resolution institutions. But we also have had the tendency now, as Catherine told, to point out that the judges have to play a role and help people to come together. And this is maybe the most difficult theoretical discussion that. Is it possible for a judge to play that role that in the beginning she or he, or during the whole time, he's working as a mediator and then he's working as a authoritative judge? So this is maybe the theoretical discussion, but we have more and more tendency towards alternatives, but very often state is active to arrange every kind of ways for using these alternatives. So.
Well, okay, thank you. Thank you all for your comments and but again also speak up. Thank you very much.